Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my privilege to present once again Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, The Science of Coercion, Blowback, and the book that we're going to be speaking about today, The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, published in softcover by the Common Courage Press. Chris, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Hello, Dave.
Your book is subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, and you begin your discussion of the relationship between those things with a discussion of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. Before getting into how that actually obtains with regard to the issue of war crimes per se, could you give us some historical background about that incident?
Well, briefly, what happened is that the Ottoman Empire, which ruled Turkey and also much of what is today Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and so forth, fabulously wealthy empire, was falling apart during the end of the last century, and the major European powers wanted a piece of it. The Turkish government, or Turkey, which was the seat of that empire, the Sultan was weak and eventually overthrown by a military junta. The junta took the name Young Turks, and this expression is in our language today. Young Turks typically mean somebody who is cruel and an insurgent type personality. In any case, one of the aspects of this particular rebellion was to try to hold the empire together, in part by exterminating Armenians, who are a nationality group in eastern Turkey. Their ancestral home is Mount Ararat in eastern Turkey, and many of your listeners may have heard of the book 40 Days of Musadeh, which is an account of the Armenian-Turkish conflict. In any case, the so-called Young Turks set out to systematically exterminate Armenians, whom they interpreted as a threat during World War I, and they did this by first of all rounding up the men in the villages and putting them to slave labor, building railroads mainly for German economic interests, and then seizing Armenian villages, seizing the women, the children, the surviving men, and deporting them on forced marches into what are today the deserts of northern Iraq and Syria, and in the process killed at least 1 million people, even by the Turks' own estimates of the day, and some estimates run twice as high. One of the noteworthy things about this particular genocide is what's happening today, and that is that the Turkish government has for 70 years systematically denied the existence of this genocide, despite proof from Turkey's own archives. You have a very large-scale publicity or propaganda campaign, you know, choose your own word, to deny that a genocide took place. One of the characteristics of this propaganda campaign is that the Turkish government endows university chairs, and basically hires gives a large pile of money to a university, the strings that are attached to the money is that they have to hire a professor who toes the line as far as the Turkish government's point of view on this question is concerned. Now, those strings are not written down. I mean, neither the universities nor the Turkish government is foolish enough to put that to paper, but that's the substance of what is taking place.
You mentioned, too, that with regard to the influence of money on the administration of law towards genocide, that a number of Western interests saw to it that the Turks were really not brought to justice for their crimes, and again, money tended to affect law with regard to genocide.
Right. I mean, part of the big idea, the overall idea of this book, is that is looking at the development of international law as it pertains to war crimes and crimes against humanity. And genocide, of course, is a crime against humanity and arguably the most horrifying crime against humanity. I argue in part that, first of all, the part of the engine that drives genocide, at least in some circumstances, is incentives that are created by the genocidal government that encourage ordinary people to persecute their neighbors by stealing their homes, their farms, their shops, and so forth. You saw this phenomena both in Turkey and later in Nazi Germany. So that's one aspect of how money plays into this. And we can talk more about that if you wish. A second aspect of how money plays into this is that as the international community attempts to articulate international law, right, come to agreement as to what international standards of conduct are, whether or not genocide is a crime, for example, as the international community attempts to do that, money, wealth, national security interests, those types of factors play a very large role in the in defining law. We can take a brief sidetrack, as is that you can see in domestic law, the way that you'll have a regulatory, say you have a industrial abuse of some sort, coming out of the United States in the last century, the railroads were absolutely notorious for monopoly abuse and systematically robbing farmers because they had a monopoly on transportation. All right, well, so there was a big controversy, and the government eventually set up the Interstate Commerce Commission, and this was a reform, and the idea was that this new body, Interstate Commerce Commission, was going to regulate the railroads in such a way that that the public interest would be protected. So that's fine. However, certainly within 20 years, the Interstate Commerce Commission and the railroads had grown so interwoven with each other as to be practically indistinguishable. What I do in my book is to in The Splendid Blonde Beast, or part of what is discussed there, is how this same convergence of interests between the crime and the law can take place on an international scale, and can also take place in extremely serious crimes that would in any usual sense of morality or ethics be horrifying. If you will permit me an example, I realize I've been going on in this particular vein for a moment, but you can see it in international law concerning bombing of cities. Now, as late as 1939, the President of the United States said that aerial bombing of an undefended city was a war crime, and that a country that did such a thing, the commanders and so forth, should be put on trial for war crimes.
This later, of course, helped to dampen the appetites of some U.S. officials to put Nazi war criminals on trial in World War II for fear of reprisal against some of our own airmen.
Well, that's true. That's true. I think more fundamentally what you see coming out of World War II is that the Nazi style of genocide, with the gas chambers and the horrifying roundups and the terrible mass murder at the edge of the ditch, that kind of genocide was clearly condemned, and the world at large acknowledges that that's a crime. the different type of mass murder, namely dropping bombs on cities or dropping missiles on cities, which is much the same thing, was not only not criminalized, it actually became the foundation of the national security strategy of both the United States and eventually the Soviet Union as well. So one type of mass murder becomes criminal, and a different type of mass murder becomes institutionalized. And so part of the book looks at how that phenomena comes to pass.
Something that I'd like to talk about in terms of the development of how money specifically influenced the development of international law concerns something that you talk about on page 46, and I'd like to read a couple of sentences and then have you explain and develop this further here. On page 46, you write, during the 1970s crisis, talking about crisis with regard to oil in the 1970s. Actually, let me start a couple of sentences up. The United States had emerged from World War I with its currency and industry stronger than ever before, at least as long as Britain and other debtors continued to pay their bills. The 1920s boom, driven by imperialism, cheap oil, and the emerging automobile economy in the U.S., created enormous pools of investment funds in the banks of New York and Boston. This led to an international financial situation that was similar in some respects to the Middle East oil crisis of the 1970s. During the 1970s crisis, the central problem from the standpoint of international finance was to recycle the massive pools of funds that had shifted to the Middle East back to the international banking network in order to stave off a string of bankruptcies that would otherwise have resulted from illiquidity in the system. During the 1970s, most of this recycling was carried out through the Eurodollar market. During the second half of the 1920s, the most important international market for recycling the new private U.S. wealth was Germany. I realize this is a tall order, Chris, but if you could explain briefly the Eurodollar situation and then how that related to the U.S. and German situation in the 1920s.
Right, right, in soundbite form of 30 seconds or less.
Sure.
This is the part of the difficulty with any kind of discussion like this, and really part of the difficulty with media is how does one explain the complexity, the real world complexity of history, when almost all of the conversation has to be reduced to sentences that are, you know, six or seven words long.
Oh, understood. It's just that this particular connection is so central to the development of your thesis.
Right, right. I'm not trying to dump on you, Dave. What I'm trying to get at is that as a society, we've got a problem in which our very misunderstanding, our the very myths by which we live, are to a certain extent structurally built in to the way that we communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, on the banking question. Well, I think we can do even more contemporary than the 1970s Eurodollar crisis, and that is what's going on today.
Sure.
with international finance. And the situation is somewhat different today for a whole string of reasons, but the element of similarity is this, that banks lend money to each other, they lend money to businesses, and this is how, you know, finance works. Fine. As long as the money keeps flowing, as long as it keeps moving around, well, then, everybody who wears a suit to work goes home at night and sleeps in peace. What I'm trying to say is that the system has the appearance of efficiency. It has the appearance of operating well. But what happens when either because of a crisis in the ability of companies to pay back their loans, or a glut, a kind of a clog, or if not to be too crude about it, it's sort of a form of economic constipation sets in which the money doesn't flow through the system in the same way. And what happens then is that you get a string of bankruptcies. one sort of falls against the next, against the next, against the next. And that is what we've been seeing over the last at least 2 years now, starting with a very little noticed and practically unreported series of bankruptcies in Thailand, and then that spreading through Asia, and then into Russia, and into South America, and increasingly into Europe. In Canada, for example, has been suffering from this for some time, and so forth and so on. So the point being is that illiquidity, that's the term, a clogging up of the circulation of capital, money, brings the system to a halt. Now, in the 1970s crisis, what happened was that OPEC for a few years was extremely effective. And the jump in the price of oil meant that huge pools of money ended up in the hands of particularly Saudi Arabia, Iran, and several other countries. And there was a very real threat or concern at the time that the whole international banking system would come unraveled because the Saudis couldn't spend their money fast enough to keep the capital circulating through banks around the world. So the euro dollar, which hadn't previously existed, is a capital market in which U.S. dollars are bought and sold and lent and traded and invested in. Using European currencies and serving primarily European or international customers. And so this was the way that the logjam was broken. Now, the bankers in your audience will point out that that's a pretty large oversimplification of what took place, and it is. But the basic point is found is that when the financial system becomes clogged that way, it comes apart, it unravels. It shuts itself down, and so that unless there is a means to break that logjam, then there's a economic crisis that can spread worldwide. Now, in the 1920s, you had somewhat the same situation. The Americans had participated in World War One at the very end, and despite all the patriotic songs and all of that, I mean, the number of casualties among the American forces were really quite low. There was no damage to the American industrial base, and both the American banks and companies came out of the war very much ahead of where they had been previously. Before the war, America, while it was powerful, and particularly powerful in Central America, was second, third, or fourth place, well behind the United Kingdom as far as world empires was concerned, well behind the French, arguably behind the Germans as well. I mean, a big part of what was going on in World War One is that the Germans had decided that they wanted an empire like the British and couldn't see any reason why they shouldn't have it, and went to war to get it.
Ein Platz unter Sonne, basically. A place in the sun.
Yeah. But as things happened, and as things happened with imperial wars, number one, the main price was not paid by the people who who set the war off. The main price was paid by ordinary people, both in terms of blood and in terms of dollars. And number two, the empires were enormously weakened. The Russian Empire, the Tsarist system was overthrown. There was a communist revolution. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, which had been previously weakened, came to an end. And there was very nearly a communist revolution in Hungary and in Germany. Germany was deeply transformed by World War One for obvious reasons. Even England, the ostensible victor in the war, only came to victory by doing what? By borrowing money from the Americans. In the same way with the French, borrowing money from the Americans. Now, meanwhile, Germany was the enemy, so they weren't borrowing money from the Americans, but when they lost the war, the British and the French and other powers went to Germany and said, you have committed, and said with some justice, by the way, you have committed war crimes against our people, you've destroyed our ships and planes and homes, well, not planes, but ships and homes and hospitals and so forth, and therefore you must pay war damages. And they haggled over the price tag for this, but when the haggling was over, it came down to something on the order of $25 billion. Now, where were the Germans going to get this sort of money? The first thing that they tried to do was through a system that amounted in essence to simply printing new Reichsmarks, printing new currency, and then using that to pay the reparations. And the result of that was the well-known German inflation crisis of the 1920s, where people were, you know, pushing around the German banknotes in wheelbarrows in order to do their grocery shopping. Meanwhile, the ostensible victors of the war, they had obligations to pay their bills too. And so what they would do is they would try to get reparations from Germany and then take those reparations and then pay the bills to the American banks, and in that way keep this cycle of capital moving, keep it revolving in the same sense that we see we were speaking of just a few moments ago about the 1970s problem or the 1990s problem. Well, when it came around to repaying the Americans, what was happening were big clogs of money in the banks in New York and in Boston, in somewhat the same way we saw in the big clogs of money in the Middle East after the jump in oil prices. So what were they going to do with this money? How were they going to invest it in, this is a capitalist system. They have to turn the money around. They have to make money with money in order for the system to continue turning over, so to speak. The engine continue to turn over, to use a metaphor. And what they did with it primarily was a system by which they took the money from the American banks and lent it back to the Germans, who then used it to do what amounted to, they did some city reconstruction with it, of cities that had been damaged by the war. But even more, what they did was what would today be called leverage buyouts, where a German entrepreneur, Friedrich Flick, to name only one example, would get cheap money from the Americans and buy his competitors in the steel and coal and iron business and build himself up into sort of the Bill Gates or the Lee Iacocca of that particular era. And then he, you know, would be forced to come up with some means of paying back those loans, and much of that he took out of the hides of the people who worked for the coal and steel industries that he had bought. So to sort of sum up all this, when you've got a perhaps it applies to any sort of international economic system, but it certainly applies to an international economic system that is built on capitalism in the sense of capital moving to be invested and to make profit on capital. When it gets clogged up, it breaks down. The system breaks down. And when the system breaks down, it causes a big crisis. When the first thing that the, you know, these sort of masters of industry, the bankers and so forth, try to do is to figure out a way to profitably reinvest it to keep the system from breaking down. I happen to live and work in Washington, D.C., and not long ago there were big meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund trying to figure out what the heck to do with the world economic crisis as it exists today. You've never seen so many limousines in your life. The city was particularly the major hotels was absolutely wall to wall with limousines and people who supposedly are concerned with dealing with curing international poverty and these sort of things, but whose personal lifestyles tend to be extremely opulent, trying to figure out what to do with the current clogging up or the current constipation, if you will, of the international monetary system. And not surprisingly, they have, at least so far, they do not appear to have succeeded at their task.
We're going to be talking about how the recapitalization of Germany in the 1920s by some of the top institutions and some of the top individuals associated with the Wall Street elite obtained on the issue of genocide, and specifically how later some of these same figures came to see the prosecution of Nazi war crimes as a poor idea under the circumstances of realpolitik that obtained at the time. We're going to deal with that, however, in our next half hour. We've been speaking with Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, The Science of Coercion, Blowback, The Splendid Blonde Beast, which we've been talking about. And, Chris, you have a new title that's just out in which you've edited works about the universities and empire.
Yeah. It deals with where ideas come from. It deals with how intellectuals work in modern societies.
And it's titled very quickly because we're almost out of time.
Universities and Empire by the New Press from New York, hardcover.
And we will be dealing with that in a future broadcast, but in our next half hour, we're going to get to the subject of how some of these events obtained on events that not only related to World War II, but had a profound influence on the course of the Cold War. For Christopher Simpson, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.